We do like to think that we're a vital stop along the road to any important elected office in the region. And today's program will feature a different format than usual, yet in the same fashion as when we hosted Clayton Harris just last week. Sat in that chair. Justice O'Neill Burke will briefly make her case here at the podium, and then she's going to sit down for a conversation and in a Q&A. And given the importance of this race, obviously, and my lack of expertise, we brought in a ringer as our guest moderator. So longtime City Club member Dwayne Deskins is here, and he's a 30-year veteran. Thank you, Dwayne. He's put a lot of work into this, so I do appreciate it. He's a 30-year veteran of the U.S. Attorney's Office, having worked as first assistant in Chicago, in Boston, in Los Angeles, in Cleveland. Dwayne knows the system, and as I said, he's done his homework on this race and the two main candidates that we've had here at City Club. So Clayton Harris sat in the seat last week and answered some tough questions. In true City Club fashion, I imagine Dwayne will pose similar questions to Justice O'Neill Burke. So buckle in for what will be an informative and substantive conversation. All the while, please remember that the views of the candidates and the moderator, of course, are don't necessarily reflect those of City Club, which is proudly nonpartisan, unbiased, or our sponsors or members. So we are proud to share this platform with all sorts of folks from all different walks of life. So know that we're not necessarily picking a side in this race, and happy to share the platform with, as I said, both leading candidates. That all said, Dwayne does have a host of questions, and if you have any to add to the conversation, please write them out now. There's some paper on your tables, and you can just wave them around. We'll make sure we get them up to Dwayne. So, for our featured speaker today, retired Justice Eileen O'Neill Burke is a candidate for Cook County State's Attorney. Eileen's experience working on the front lines of the justice system began when she served as Cook County State's Attorney. As a Cook County State's Attorney, handling felony appellate cases, working in juvenile court and felony review. After a decade as a prosecutor, Eileen worked as a criminal defense attorney. In 2008, Eileen was elected to the Circuit Court of Cook County, presiding over civil court litigation. In 2016, she was elected Justice of the First District Appellate Court in Cook County. During her time on the bench, Justice O'Neill Burke served as a judicial faculty member, teaching both trial and appellate court judges in a wide variety of legal areas. She has a passion for training the newest judges and has taught civil procedures to new judges since 2012. Please welcome to City Club, Justice Eileen O'Neill Burke. Thank you, Justice. There you go.
Thank you. Thank you, Dan, for that intro. I've even wanted to make sure that I brought my speech up with me. Oh, the napkin. Oh. I have campaign voice, so please excuse me. I got lozenges up here. They're giving me throat coat tea. We're all good. So thank you so much for coming. I feel like I made it. I'm at the City Club. It doesn't get better than that. So, as Dan told you, my name is Eileen O'Neill Burke. I am running for the Democratic nomination for Cook County State's Attorney. I've been a state's attorney. I've been a criminal defense attorney. I was a trial court judge. And for the last 7 years, I sat on the appellate court. I stepped down from the appellate court in July of this year to run for this office. So the question I get asked all the time is, why would you do this? But it's an answer that I think many of you in this room share. I love Chicago. I was born and raised on the Northwest Side. I met my husband first day, first year of law school. We raised our four children here. My family's been here for generations. I'm not giving up on Chicago. Chicago is smack dab in the center of this country. We have air, we have port, we have rails, we have a fresh water supply. The skyline of this city takes my breath away every single time I see it. We should be booming right now, but we're not. Instead, we have businesses and people leaving, and they're leaving because of crime. I'm talking to people all over the county, all over the city, every day. And I'm hearing the same thing. People are afraid. They're afraid to go out at night. They're afraid to come downtown. They're afraid to ride the CTA. When people are afraid, they will leave. Our justice system is not working right now. But I don't think any of you need me to tell you that. Anybody who reads the news or watches the news at night can tell you that. You could ask any victim, any witness, any defendant if they think our justice system is working just fine right now, and they will tell you it is not. But we can fix it. When I became a state's attorney in 1991, there were 2,300 applications for 50 spots. It was a highly coveted job, and I can guarantee you that not one of us went to the state's attorney's office to make money. What we went there for was the experience and the training. I can tell you every single state's attorney remembers what it felt like to stand up in court and say, I am here on behalf of the people of the state of Illinois. It was not just a feeling of pride, but it was a feeling of responsibility. We were there to represent the victims of crime. That's a heady thing for a 25, 26-year-old. But it was something that we all loved. Right now, the state's attorney's office is woefully understaffed and mismanaged. Instead of having a surplus of candidates, we have a vacancy rate that is making this system not work. The state's attorney's office is the backbone of the criminal justice system. The state's attorney is the one who decides who gets charged with a crime. They decide what they're going to get charged with. Under the Safety Act, they make the initial determination if somebody gets detained. They make the call on whether somebody gets to plead a case out or whether they're going to go to trial. And they also make a recommendation for sentencing. So at each and every step of a criminal prosecution, the state's attorney is the primary actor. When the backbone is not working, the whole system breaks down. But we can fix it. So what I want to do is I want to create the best training ground for prosecutors in the entire nation. I've already started recruiting several retired judges, some of which are in that second table right there, to form an education unit with me. We are going to form a curriculum that covers the Constitution and the case law and what are the courtroom skills that are necessary for you to be effective at your job. This is going to be the gold standard for training of prosecutors in this country. I want every other jurisdiction looking at Cook County. What are they doing differently there? Because we're going to get our crime rates down. But I also want to form a restorative justice bureau. And everybody throws that term around, and it means different things to different people. So I will tell you exactly what I'm talking about. Restorative justice courtrooms are for nonviolent felony offenses. They're geared for specific types of offenders, people struggling with drug addiction, mental illness, veterans. They're a collaborative approach with the judge, the defense attorney, and the prosecutor to figure out what does this person need to get back on track. They're actually having success with these programs. Their repeat offender rates are significantly less. So not only does it make us morally better as a society if we can get people turned around before they go to violent crime, but it's fiscally better. These programs cost a fraction of what it costs to incarcerate someone. So I know this staffing isn't all that sexy of a topic to talk about. Like, she talks about staffing a lot. But the reason why I cover staffing first is because our justice system is having significant pressures right now. So the first pressure is this entire county is awash in guns. And it's not just any guns. They're guns with a switch converting it to an automatic weapon with an extended magazine. We're seeing these guns everywhere. The two boys who were shot at Washington and Wabash, 20 shots rang out in 5 seconds. It's one of these guns. The officer who was shot at State and Walton, the offender was found with one of these guns. The mass shooting in Lawndale 2 months ago, 15 people were shot that had nothing to do with the dispute. It's these guns. They're very difficult to control when you equip a gun with a switch and an extended magazine. They just spray bullets. We have a tool. The tool is the assault weapons ban. It bans the use of the switch and extended magazine. We need to enforce this tool. We can do this. We can make things better by enforcing the law. It elevates the class of offense. It extends the term of sentence. We need to ask for detention each and every time someone is found with one of these guns. We will continue to see these mass shootings until we get control of that. The second pressure point that we're seeing on our criminal justice system right now is the Safety Act. So the Safety Act fundamentally changes how we approach pretrial detention in the criminal justice system. So we've all seen it. Judges used to set a bond, and the bond would be commensurate with the seriousness of the offense. So if it was a murder, a judge had set a $1 million bond. That was judges' way of keeping someone detained if they presented a danger to the community. So the criterion now is, are you a danger to the public or are you not? If you're not a danger to the public, you don't need to be incarcerated before you're found guilty. I think we can all agree with that. That should be the criterion. Are you a danger or are you not? If you're a danger, you should be detained. So that's a significant change. We're the first state in the nation to try to do this. And I don't think anybody really has a beef with that portion of the Safety Act. But the other thing the Safety Act does is it fundamentally changes the state's attorney's role in detention. Now, in order to detain anyone, the state's attorney must first file a petition to detain. If the state's attorney does not file that petition to detain, it doesn't matter if somebody is a mass killer or a terrorist, the judge has to release the offender. So it's become exponentially more important that somebody who's running the state's attorney's office knows what they're doing and puts in place structure, training, criteria for when we will seek detention. The third pressure point that we're seeing right now is retail theft. This entire county is rife with retail theft right now. So the felony retail theft statute says the value of the goods is $300 or above. The current state's attorney has said that they will not prosecute if the value of the goods is $1,000 or less. Well, you can clear out several aisles of a grocery store or a Walgreens before you get to $1,000. I think we've all seen this. We've all seen the ramifications of this policy. Walgreens, CVS, Target, Walmart are closing all over the county, and they are closing because of theft. They cannot do business this way. So my view is I took an oath as a judge. I'll take the same oath as state's attorney that I will uphold the law. If there's an appetite to change the law, the correct way to do that is go to Springfield and change the law. Get the threshold lifted to $1,000, and I will enforce that law. But it's not appropriate for an office holder just to say, I'm not going to enforce the law because I don't like it. That's not the right way to do it. But that doesn't mean that every single person charged with retail theft should go to jail. Prosecutors have a wide range of options available to us. If somebody doesn't have a background and they pick up their first retail theft, they go to theft school, they don't get arrested again, it's gone. It's off the record. It doesn't permanently harm them. Then you grade it up to supervision, probation, and jail time if the offender or the offense warrants that. But we need to enforce the law. The behavior has been accelerating. So the Retail Merchants Association took me on a tour a couple of weeks ago of two stores, one Walgreens in Little Village and a Home Depot in Little Village. And the amount of remediation measures that are going in on a Walgreens are astounding. Everything is locked up. Everything is behind plexiglass and a lock. They have to hire full-time security. They had to remove their emergency exit doors. So it started with one person coming in with a backpack, filling it up, and walking out the door. Then it graded up to five people coming in, filling up their backpacks, and going out the door. Now they're seeing five people come in, they spray the workers with pepper spray, fill up their backpacks, and leave. The behavior is accelerating. We need to enforce the law. That is not radical. That's not an extreme view. So we can fix this. We can make this the best training ground for prosecutors in the entire nation. We can make this fair, effective, effective and innovative prosecutor's office. That's my goal. That's why I stepped down from the appellate court to run for this office. And that's why I'm here today. So I'm looking forward to my grilling. And he said, what do you want me to call you? It's always like you don't know what to call your mother-in-law the first time you meet her. Like, do I call you judge? Do I call you? What do I call you? So I said, well, if we're going with titles, let's go with judge, but just call me Eileen. So he said, you better tell them that you said it was okay to call me Eileen. So, and it's okay for everybody to call me Eileen.
Ken, is there mics on? Can you hear us all? Oh, great. I would also, the rest of that conversation went something like, well, what should I call you? And I said, judge, whatever you want to call me. I think anybody who's a lawyer knows that's how the deal works. Dan was very kind. So that you know, ladies and gentlemen, I've worked for 9 presidents, 2 Fed chairs, 9 attorney generals, 16 U.S. attorneys, 1 mayor, and I was the first assistant county prosecutor. Male, female, black, white, Republicans, Democrats, doesn't really much matter. The point is that you want to get somebody good in this job. So I appreciate both Mr. Harris and Eileen coming in today. We want to start off the same way. If I asked you, give me 3 words to describe what a good prosecutor is, what would you choose?
Fair, thoughtful, and trained.
I also wanted to find out, what do you see the role of the prosecutor's office in the sense of the government overall, just so you have a sense of what I'm going at? It's for me, I see it cops, courts, and prosecutors on one side, and on the other side, the mayor, governor, city, business, and philanthropy. In the same way I did earlier, kind of monetary policy, blunt tools that the cops and courts and prosecutors have to try and cool things off when it gets hot. And that the other folks have that huge amass of resources and people and time to try and make sure the fiscal part stays good. But for you, how do you see it?
It's definitely a independent office that mm-hmm. has to interact with other offices. We have to have a working relationship with the police departments mm-hmm. in all the suburbs, with the sheriff's department, with CPD. The mayor's office, the mayor did something really, really good. And I want to give him credit for it. He picked an excellent police commander. He's thoughtful and he's smart and he has the rank and file respect, and we will work very, very well together. So.
And for the rest of it, that's Commander Snelling you're referring
yes,
to.
Yes, yes.
Yes. Now, Superintendent Snelling. You joined the prosecutor's office, the state's attorney's office, in 1990?
91.
91. That was right out of law school.
Yeah, my husband and I got married, and I was doing a couple other things in between graduation, and I started in April of 91.
We don't need to get into all of that, but the in 1991 you joined. Tell me why you joined, especially given the fact that there's so many African Americans that are defendants in the criminal court system, not just here but around the country.
I joined in 1991 because it was the place to learn how to be a trial attorney. There was no better. And then the ironic part about that was I fell in love with appeals, and I ended up staying in appeals, and I was a supervisor in appeals, and the amount of experience. So this is the great part about the state's attorney's office. I had 100 appeals by the time I left appeals. There is nobody in a law firm that would have 100 appeals and 40 arguments. There is, and that was the beauty of working for the state's attorney's office, of the amount of training you would get. I mean, somebody who comes through 26th Street is going to have 60 juries. That's unheard of in a law firm. You would never have that amount of experience. So that was why I went there. And you're absolutely right. Like, the majority of defendants were black and brown people. And that's still true today. That's the majority of defendants right now. And as you go through the system, you see the patterns. In juvenile court, you would see the kids who are in abuse and neglect. then a couple of years later, you'd see him in delinquency. And then a couple of years later, you would see him in the felony trial courts. You're absolutely right. And to have that view of the entire system like that and then to go do defense was invaluable. It opened my eyes to a completely different viewpoint.
Let me go a little bit deeper in that, because I think of the two candidates in this race, you have a unique perspective because of the time you were there, almost 10 years or so, you worked under two different prosecutors. So the first person you worked for really did not have any prior prosecution or criminal justice experience. And so I want to give you, let's divide your experience there in half. Can you describe under that first prosecutor where you joined the office, how cases were investigated, charged, and assigned?
So the first state's attorney I worked for was Jack O'Malley. And I did not notice, as I was pretty low on the totem pole, though, so I don't know that I would notice structural changes or big policy decisions. But I will say this. I felt respected and valued under both Dick Devine and Jack O'Malley. I felt like they cared about the people who worked for them, and they wanted to see them develop and grow as attorneys so that they would be even more valuable to the state's attorney's office. I don't see that happening right now.
How were cases assigned, though? Do you remember how they were assigned under Mr. O'Malley?
I wish I knew.
It's a while, so I'm just asking.
Yeah.
Did you have many trials?
Yes, especially in juvenile court.
Really?
That's all we did was trials all day long.
So were you in juvenile court during O'Malley's tenure?
Yes.
Okay. And ballpark number, more than 100, less than?
Oh, more than 500 probably.
Okay.
I mean, we would do, and I had two partners that kept sticking me with all the victim crimes because they were harder. And so now I remember how cases were assigned. One person in the courtroom would assign the cases, and then you had to go issue all the subpoenas, do all the workup and everything. Mm-hmm. So I had one guy that all of a sudden I noticed he was doing all the gun cases, which a gun case requires one officer to testify. And I was getting like the ones that needed five people. And so that's how they were assigned.
Okay.
Now I'm angry about that. Now that you've reminded me of that.
Good point.
Yeah.
Tell me, how was training done during that time?
So we would do a NITA training, National Institutes of Trial Advocacy. We would do a NITA training. But it was high pressure. I mean, that was a tryout.
So, for the benefit of people who don't know.
So it's like you go to a week-long class and they have you perform kind of. Here you're going to do a closing argument. You're going to do a cross-examination. But all the supervisors of the state's attorney's office would be there. So they were looking at who's the talent coming up. So it was a lot of pressure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Was that valuable? Did they have any kind of in-house training?
No, that was it.
Okay. And this is while you're still in
juvenile. We're going to change that.
Well, that's until in juvenile.
Yes.
Yeah, just so you know, when I was the head of the juvenile unit, we had Fridays at 3, every Friday, 3 o'clock, put the books down, and we did mock trials. And we used the people in the office from the top of the food chain, so to speak, the top lawyers and the judges. That would come in. I'm sure the lawyers, were not thrilled to put the work down, but that's how you learn. And my thought was that we never had to worry about getting credits for their bar, because every week you got credits for your bar. And there was no excuses. The top guy was pretty mean.
So when I read up on Dwayne, I started seeing all the things he'd done at juvenile court, and I was like, oh, my God, we could totally get in the weeds on this conversation, and nobody else would like this.
But training matters.
Yeah.
So when Mr. Devine came in, I want to ask kind of the same questions. Did things change? Because he had been a former first assistant county prosecutor. Did you notice any changes in the office?
So by then, I had gone through felony review, and I was back in appeals. And I have a lot of children, so I was just doing my work. I wasn't paying attention to the policy.
So can you, just for the benefit of the audience, just explain how, so if I started, again, under Mr. O'Malley or Mr. Devine, how did I rotate through that office?
So everybody would start in appeals or traffic court, and then you would get promoted to juvenile or misdemeanor court. And then from there, you would go to felony review. So felony review is a place where no one in Cook County can be charged with a felony until an assistant state's attorney comes out and evaluates the case and determines if they have a sufficient basis to bring a felony charge. They also make sure they get statements from all the witnesses. They make sure that certain reports are ordered, 911 tapes are saved. It's the investigation process of the state's attorney's office. We are the only jurisdiction, to my knowledge, that does this in the entire country. So it came about when Richie Daley was state's attorney and the consent decree came down, and he did it voluntarily to help the police to make sure there was a catch on any felony charges.
Interesting. There is, give me a sense of the population. So, were there more prosecutors under Mr. O'Malley or more under Mr. Devine?
So fully staffed at the state's attorney's office is about 800 or 900 attorneys. Mm-hmm. And probably we were close to capacity in both of those. And there was always a line out the door waiting, you know, for people to come in. And one of my bosses used to say, anytime somebody complained, well, there's plenty of people who are willing to take your place. So that it cut the complaining off a little bit. But I didn't notice a difference between the two of them. But there's a huge difference now because they're not fully staffed and they're hurting for people. So you should have three attorneys at 26th Street handling a docket of about 300 cases. What you have right now is two attorneys, sometimes one attorney, handling a docket of 700 cases. That is a recipe for disaster. That is, there will be mistakes that happen because of that, because there's not enough hours in the day to do what needs to be done.
I want to now kind of pivot to another topic area, and that's based on your remarks that you're returning or want to return to the office, but people here are looking for results, bottom line. And 35,000 people have been shot or killed in the past 10 years, but the number of people who are being charged with a violation for that, for homicide or shootings, is like 18% for homicide or 4.5% per shooting. The homicides are 5 times higher than New York, 3 times higher than L.A., and they've been that way for 2 decades. Robberies and thefts, as you mentioned, are on the rise. Carjacking, car thefts are up 233% compared to 2019. As you mentioned, downtown shootings are up. Retail theft is up 94% since they changed the policy there on how much to charge. I will note that I went into a store with a friend. One purse, don't know much about purse prices, but one purse in Neiman Marcus is $1,500. I don't think you could go to parts of Englewood and buy $1,500 worth of anything out of any store. The Mag Mile, a fifth of all the jobs in Chicago. I was shocked. I learned that here at the City Club. A fifth of all the jobs in Chicago are on the Mag Mile.
And which is a third vacant right now.
Which is amazing. And then you mentioned the Harris poll. 40% of the people in the city and 54% of the people in the suburbs don't want to come downtown. And so when you talk about results, what can people expect from you in your first or second or third year? What can they actually expect? And I will say that, you know, the line always that people give politicians, well, it took a long time to get here, you know. Well, it takes 2 or 3 years to build a building here, and as all of you know, and it takes to knock it down in an hour. So what can we expect to see?
All right, I wrote this down because I had so many thoughts that were coming in. Okay. So I don't want to have a one-year plan. I want to have a day one plan. Okay. So the Republicans have not won this office since 1991. So that was before most of my campaign staff was even born. So it was a long time ago. So I don't feel like I'm measuring for drapes before I bought the house. But we are going to have a transition team in place within a month after the election. So on day one, I want to have specific focus teams on our transition team. We have to have a recruiting and a marketing plan of what's going to be instituted day one. We are going to have a training and education plan for each and every level of the state's attorney's office. So, for example, juvenile court is governed by the Juvenile Court Act. They will study the Juvenile Court Act. Narcotics is governed by the Fourth Amendment and search and seizure law. They will have a curriculum for that to study that. So that will be in place, ready to go with who our instructors are going to be. We are going to have a criterion for detention on day one. We will change the policy on day one. So the criterion, I don't believe in playing hide the ball. You said the politicians say it takes a long time to get there. I'm not a politician, so we're going to get there, and we're going to get there quickly. So the state will ask for detention each and every time an assault weapon or a switch with an extended magazine is present. We are going to ask for detention each and every time someone uses a gun in the commission of a felony. We're going to use ask for detention each and every time a violent crime is committed on the CTA. In order to have a vibrant, thriving city, you need to have a safe public transportation system. We don't have that right now. So I did criminal defense for 8 years. I can tell you they will know, criminals will know that something has changed and the behavior will change. They will know, oh, you don't want to commit an offense on the CTA because they'll ask for detention and jail time. They will know, oh, if you get caught with an assault weapon, they will ask for detention and jail time. We can change the behavior very quickly by our policies. I want to talk a little bit about a policy that is currently in place. The current state's attorney does not believe in accountability. So accountability, and people think I'm talking about something else. I'm talking about the legal theory of accountability, which says if you participate before, during, or after the commission of a felony, it is as if you pulled the trigger, committed the felony yourself. So I'll give you an example. Let's say there are five people in a car that are going to do a gang drive-by shooting. The one person who shoots and kills someone will be charged with murder. The other four people in the car will be released. Once those four people go back to the neighborhood with no prosecution and no charges, you will never get a witness to come forward. And you know this as well as I do. You will not have a witness come forward. So now we're looking at Inglewood has a 10% murder clearance rate. 10%. That means 9 out of 10 people are getting away with murder in Inglewood. That is not acceptable in any part of this county. And it's directly attributable to that current policy. That will be changed day one.
But can we expect certain metrics from you? Thank you. Can we expect certain metrics from you in terms of the reduction in homicides and shootings? For example, there is a group in Chicago, the CIV people, and they, group of government officials and non-governmental officials, community violence intervention people, say that they can get homicides in half here in 5 years, and they're predicting a 75% reduction in homicides in 10 years. To be fully transparent about it, they say they're also going to need $400 million to do so.
But they ponied up $200 million.
Correct.
Yeah.
Do you think that your efforts can yield those kinds of results?
I do. And all of this is going to be getting all oars in the water. That means getting all government stakeholders to be working together. That's the chief judge's office. That's the Chicago Police Department. That's every municipality, the sheriff's department, and it's the business community. Because, well, when we talk about juvenile court, we'll pivot to that. But we need everybody working on this program together. And that's their goal, is 5 years to have this be the safest city in America. That's my goal. We're going to turn this around. There's no doubt in my mind that we're going to turn this around. We're going to turn it around by having an effective prosecutor's office that's also innovative, that we can implement things here that are tested in universities that they're having success with. So, for example, Washington, D.C. has a mental health court that they're actually having success with. They're getting people off the street and restored to productive citizens. DuPage County has a model drug court for the entire nation. We don't need to reinvent the wheel. We need to figure out what's working and implement it here.
Do you have, and again, I now want to pivot a little bit, and I don't mean to cut you off. Do you have a strategic plan? Do you have something that the people here or the people who are going to be watching the live stream, that's something that they can read that gives them an overview of what it is you want to do and how effective it will be?
Yes, I do have a plan. It is not on my website because most campaign people aren't like me and you that would love to read a policy statement. They really want to hear the top line things. But yes, I have a plan, and that plan is going to be implemented hopefully on day one, because this is a job we are going to start planning right in April. We are going to start planning on each and every level of the state's attorney's office. We're going to do a top-to-bottom analysis of what's working. We're going to have to do some triage. That's without a doubt. We have to do some triage because we're so woefully understaffed. So part of my triage plan is I want to get one paralegal for every two courtrooms. And the paralegals, so right now, every single offense has video evidence. But the way we get video evidence is, here's 6 hours of videotape, of which you might need 35 seconds. So we need to have a paralegal going through there, finding the 35 seconds, tendering the 6 hours with the redaction to the defense so we can start getting through this logjam. The other thing I want to do is, I've been hearing a lot all over the county, people saying, I had a case, I never heard anything about it, and the next thing I knew, it was dismissed. I want to work with the circuit court clerk's office to have a system where a victim, a witness, a defendant, the judge, the prosecutor, the defense attorney can log in to every case and they can see exactly where the status is. They can see the arraignment date happened on this date. They can see the next court date is going to be this. Forensics report was added on this date. We're waiting on an APHIS hit so that nobody will be caught unaware of what's happening in their case, especially the defendants. They need to know.
But I think it's also fair to push back a little bit and say, as I said to Mr. Harris, you lost your campaign 8 months ago, and he did as well. Is it unfair to expect that we couldn't see right now, before we vote, a plan from either of you that tells us, here's what I want to do, here's how I'm going to do it, here's what the results of it are? Just think of it as one big grant application, that it would be pretty standard to say, here's what I'm going to do, here's how I'm going to do it, and here's the results that you should find from that. Is there a reason why we can't see that before we vote?
You know,
I'm just asking.
No, I think it's a valid question, although you are the first person of the multitude of people I've met on the campaign trail asking me for a policy. So I'm going to do
Here's
it.
Here's one looks like.
I like it.
I wrote
but
it.
My campaign staff would freak out if I told
it's
them
we had pages.
To do that. Yeah.
I mean, that's for a law student, that would be a good day.
Yeah. Yes, it would be. I think it's a great idea, but I do. Each and every time I'm talking to people, I'm answering questions just like this. What do we want to do? And I have a plan on where we're going to go with this.
Okay. I want to talk to you about plans to take on violent crime in particular, and you've talked about them a little bit. But the current prosecutor says that the police don't bring us cases, and you can't make a case if you don't have a case. And yet, if we look around, and I'm not asking you your views about it, but if you look at the prosecutions against Donald Trump, they're being led by prosecutors, either federal prosecutors or in Georgia, the Georgia prosecutor. Who's going to lead in Chicago and Cook County on our cases?
So a couple different things. There is no trust between CPD and the state's attorneys right now.
Right.
None. And so we need to have a working relationship. The police bring us all of our witnesses, all of our statements, all of our evidence. We need to have a working relationship with them, and it doesn't exist right now. So what I want to do to rebuild the relationship is, the first thing I want to do is, anytime there's an allegation of unconstitutional policing or officer misconduct or a police shooting, I want a hard and fast wall to go up between the state's attorney's office and special prosecuting unit. Those special prosecutors will be attorneys of the highest legal regard in this county. They will conduct the investigation and the prosecution of officers, just because it does not work to be prosecuting officers on one hand and then asking their partners and their colleagues to come help us build cases on the other hand. The other thing I want to do is, I want to put brand new cadets out of the academy with brand new state's attorneys in a week-long class. And every day they're going to cover something they're going to see every day. First day is going to be, what's a Terry stop? What does the Constitution say? What are the parameters of it? When do you need a search warrant? When do you have to Mirandize someone? How do you have to treat juveniles differently than adult offenders? We're going to cover every bit of law that they need to know before they're out on the street. And then in the afternoon, I want to have the brand new state's attorney put the brand new cadet on the stand, and they're going to practice, do an motion to quash, a motion to suppress, a direct exam. So no one will go into court cold, and I think we can start to knit back the relationship. And the secondary product of it is, we are going to have the best versed on the law and the Constitution police department and state's attorney's office.
I want to ask in that regard, please. In that regard, I want to talk a little bit about what your specific plans are to reduce the violence in the city. For example, are you going to use multi-defendant cases where you have four, five, six, or seven people at a time or more who are charged in one case in front of one judge?
Yes. So we do multi-defendant litigation in Cook County. What has happened is, because of the severe attrition in the state's attorney's office, supervisors and first chairs left. So that's the dearth of institutional knowledge. Those were the people that would train the younger people. How do you do a murder case? How do you do multi-defendant litigation? How do you do things that are more complicated? And that's gone. So not only do we have a problem with getting cases in, when we do get cases, we might not have somebody who's trained enough to do it. So that's the first problem, is that we're going to be training and restaffing. Multi-defendant litigation is a bear. It's tricky. And it's something that someone has to know how to do. So that's going to be one of the topics that we cover in our weekly trainings, is going to be multi-defendant litigation.
Will you get pushback from the judges who are now, as you say, accustomed to one defendant, one case, and to say, we're going to do 10, 15, 20 perhaps?
Well, I've never heard of that in Cook County, that many. I've seen three or four simultaneous juries going, and yeah, the judges are equipped for it. The judges know how to do it. Yeah. They're well versed in doing that. When you start getting into the double digit defendants, just physically, our space doesn't really allow for that.
So you will do multi-defendant cases?
Absolutely.
All right.
It saves resources. It saves the state's attorney's resources. It saves the court system resources, the police resources.
Exactly. I think Dick Devine said on this very stage, when he charged 25 defendants in a trial in front of one judge, it's the difference between looking at a jigsaw puzzle, what's fully complete, and one that shows you one little tiny piece.
Exactly.
You don't really appreciate what's there. I want to also just ask you a little bit about legislation. There is legislation already and a law on the books in the state of Illinois that increases the penalties for people from 3 years to 6 to 7 for aggravated use of a gun and for unlawful use of a gun by a felon. It's due to sunset. Do you think we should continue it?
Absolutely. We're in the middle of a crime wave, which is part of guns. So if I could address one issue that's currently happening right now. So the restorative justice courtrooms that I talked about that they're addressed for mentally ill people or drug addiction or veterans. There's three courtrooms in Avondale, Lawndale, and Inglewood, which were geared for those types of offenses, those types of offenders, nonviolent felonies. 83% of them have been converted into gun deferral courtrooms. So what that means is somebody gets caught with an illegal weapon, they go to a gun deferral courtroom, which these systems have never been tested for gun cases. They go to these gun deferral courtrooms and there's no prosecution. It's deferred. Prosecution is deferred. It is using up the restorative justice courtroom's bandwidth for something that it was never intended for. So, yes, we are going to reconvert those courtrooms back into the restorative justice courtrooms that they are intended for, that have been studied, that have been effective for, and we're going to not be doing a gun deferral program.
Okay. I want to pivot now to we've talked about what you want to do, kind of goals, aspirational goals, and now I want to pivot to the issue of experience. In other words, are you the right person to get that done? And I want to say, just by way of preference, that so there's no confusion, I know you and Mr. Harris both know this, that the word experience is not the same thing as the word qualification. The word qualification is ultimately up to the voters. Each of them get to decide what and who is qualified for that job. And certainly experience is a component of that, but it's not the same thing as that. And as I said, qualifications are up to the voters to decide. If elected, though, it's fair to say, I think, that in terms of experience coming in as the prosecutor's office, as a judge in the appeals court, you have the most experience in the criminal courts and in the court system and in the office of anybody in 40 years. Pretty fair to say. But also, I know you know this from your prior interviews, is that there's been a question raised regarding your experience as it bears upon your qualifications. And we've just met today, but this is the issue to do about your judgment in connection with your role as a trial prosecutor in a case 30 years ago involving an 11-year-old defendant, A.M., for the brutal murder of Anna Gillis. Would you like to talk about that?
So 30 years, I prosecuted a juvenile who had confessed to the brutal murder of his next-door neighbor. His attorney made the decision to put him on the stand where he repeated the confession. The juvenile, his mother, his attorney never alleged that that statement was coerced or in any way inappropriate. The case went up on appeal. The juvenile was found delinquent. We don't say they're found guilty. The juvenile was found delinquent. He was given 5 years probation, and he went home to his family. The case was appealed. The appellate court affirmed the conviction. The Supreme Court denied review. 8 years later, it went to federal court, and in the intervening time, one of the investigating officers was found to have engaged in misconduct in getting a confession from a different juvenile. So the federal court, armed with that new information, said his attorney erred. His attorney should have challenged that confession. And by not doing so, his attorney was ineffective. My conduct was never questioned in that case or any other case. The only time my conduct has ever been questioned was by my opponent and his allies.
If I just ask the question? I think the folks here would like to know, did you have a role in the investigation of that case or the determination of its charging?
No.
Do you know who did? How was that done at that time, I guess?
I really have no idea. Yeah.
And he went, that juvenile also went into custody after he was found delinquent?
No, he went home to his family.
I thought
custody was not allowed for an 11-year-old.
I mean, by custody, I'm talking Children and Family Services custody.
No, he went home to his family.
And you're sure of that?
Yeah, I'm positive.
Okay. In connection with that, there is, again, kind of the follow-on question is that, do you have the judgment to resist these unscrupulous police officers when they do appear, looking for a conviction, and at the same time, to lead a police department to protect the public from violent offenders. And if you want to talk about that a little bit.
So if I had any indication at all, if anyone had any indication at all that that officer was engaged in misconduct, I would have not proceeded on that case. That's not even a question. But no one had any indication that the officer had engaged in any type of activity that was unconstitutional. No one, specifically from the juvenile or his attorney, made any allegation that anything untoward happened during that confession. If I had known, then no, I would not have proceeded on that case. But I did not have the ability to look into the future. So I did my job on that case. My job was, this is a confession case. It was a year had gone by between the arrest and the murder. It was a confession case. Because of that year-long lapse, there was no physical evidence. That was not, you know, to be expected. But there was no indication that that statement was in any way coerced from the juvenile or his attorney.
And I want to make sure, because I've read a lot of different accounts of what happened in that case. But as I read one account, and I'm asking you to make sure that I got it right, or the writer got it right, there were five statements made by the juvenile. Four of the five involved a neighbor. Two of the five involved AM and the neighbor in the case. And the last one was the one that said AM did it by himself.
I'm going to have to back up. So the detectives, it was a cold case, meaning nobody's ever been arrested on it. They were reviewing the reports and they see a juvenile had said he saw somebody walking out of the victim's apartment. So they went to talk to the juvenile and he gave them a specific name of someone saying this was the man that was walking out of her apartment. So they extradite this man from another state, bring him back to Chicago. They go to the juvenile's home and they said to his mother, he needs to view a lineup and can we go to the police station now? And the mother said, I'm busy, go ahead and take him. So they took him to the police station. This guy had an alibi. He wasn't in the state when the murder occurred. He was swearing up and down he had nothing to do with the victim. So when the officer said to this kid, if you just made it up, just tell us, the story was changing. And so they were saying to him, we cannot charge this man with murder if you just made it up. And that's when he blurts out, I did it. I killed her. So his mother wasn't there. He wasn't Mirandized. I was surprised when his attorney didn't try to quash that confession, but that was the case.
There was another aspect of it, and I say this just, again, it's an account that none of us was actually present. But the account was that it had been a brutal murder. Woman bound, legs, arms, neck. The implement used, according to AM, was a rope that you would hang flowers from. It turns out it was a telephone cord and some kind of a piece of material that was used to bind her. There was a variance between what he said in that final statement and that those facts, I guess. And then the second was the issue of the woman was found in the bathroom. And I think, again, correct me again, I think AM said that she crawled to get there, but there was some suggestion that she was dragged, and by a kid who's certainly very small relative to, I think she was 173 and he was 88 pounds. Were there things, enough things in there that would have led you to have pause as to whether or not the myriad of statements he made, that whether or not this was the final one, was the accurate one?
No, when you have a cold case, there's a difference in recall of the facts to that. And it's my job to put it in front of the trier of fact. And the trier of fact makes the determination, with all these inconsistencies that the defense brings up, if we've met our burden of proof. It is not up to the prosecutor to only bring perfect cases. When a case is reversed, it does not mean the prosecutor engaged in misconduct. Okay. That's a leap that we're making here.
I think we're like on the edge of the
okay.
of the
right,
so
right.
I'm not going to belabor the point, but so the people understand there are no jury trials in juvenile cases.
It's a
so
judge.
The judge who would have heard the motion to suppress would be the same judge that would have decided the case.
Yes.
All right. If I could just bear with just a couple of minutes, just 2 minutes more, and I won't keep you. You talked about the issue of felony review. What role did they play in terms of search warrants? As you know, there's a controversy over Anjanette Young.
Yes.
The police went to the wrong place with a search warrant, but there was no, and you know this, Judge, is that the system is not perfect, but it's built on redundancy.
Absolutely.
And so when the police get a search warrant, it's reviewed for legal sufficiency and accuracy by the prosecutor's office, one level of redundancy. It's reviewed again by a judge, another level of redundancy before you even leave the door.
Right.
What are you going to do to make sure there are fewer of those instances where the redundancy fails?
Anytime a search warrant is issued, each and every statement that's contained in that search warrant, the house has to be verified. And it's easy to verify a house. You Google it, you ask your witness, is this the house, you know, that you are claiming you went into? Those things have to be done on each and every case. You need to have verification of the apartment, the store. And I think it helps to make sure that judges are trained in search warrants, along with state's attorneys, so we all know exactly where it is. And until you've done that training, you shouldn't be, you know, a lot of times police officers will call a judge they know and say, hey, can you sign a search warrant for me? That's a bad idea. It's a terrible idea because they might not know what to look for in that search warrant because they might be a civil court judge.
And also the questions are, you know, the idea of having a judge is that the judge is independent.
Exactly.
And if you call the person you know, that does suggest that it's not.
And there's ways to do it where somebody is the duty judge and then they're covering it every day. And it's somebody who deals with this every day. So you can take a look at it at a glance. Once you've done 500 of these, you can at a glance look at a search warrant and know whether it's sufficient or not. Know whether you've checked your boxes.
Right. I think that, you know, I would be less than candid if I did. We went a little bit over the schedule. Dan gave me one question, and I would like to at least get that in, if I may. So where are you in the process of violence reduction and the use of technology?
You mean like a bioscan?
Bio shot spotter.
We're still not at a lie detector being sufficiently reliable to go into a courtroom. Is it a tool? Is shot spotter a tool? They're tools, but they don't rise to the level of the Frye standard. Frye standard means it's been sufficiently tested to use it as evidence in a courtroom. Are they tools? Yes. They're tools that we can use in order to investigate crime. But do I think they should be admissible? Not yet.
Well, again, Judge Eileen, thank you so much for your time and the City Club and the members.
Thank you, Eileen. Thank you, Justice O'Neill Burke. Thank you, Duane. Thanks, everybody, for being here. I certainly learned a lot about the system from Thursday and today. And, of course, we hope anyone who is not decided on their vote in this incredibly important election will come to our website. We're going to release videos from both programs tomorrow, right about this time. And you'll be able to see these programs again. And so much more to come. Thank you for being here. Please come back to City Club. Lots to come soon. Thanks, Justice O'Neill Burke.